This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the agenda today, the very future of the global economy. That's it. No big deal. The fate of the European Union and of NAFTA as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 20th day of March. Glad you could be with us, everybody, as we always are. By the way, it was a busy, busy day on Capitol Hill today. The Comey-Russia hearings on the House side, the Gorsuch confirmation hearings on the Senate side, news of which is everywhere. We, meanwhile, are going to bring you tomorrow's news today, or more accurately, 2 years from next Wednesday's news. Today, we can do that because this morning, the British government told the European Union that it's going to formally start Brexit negotiations on March 29th. That gives the Brits 2 years to extricate themselves from the EU with, they hope, minimal economic damage. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, it is likely to be 2 years of extremely hard bargaining.
Prime Minister May is touring the UK before triggering the exit talks next week. Today, she was in Wales selling the economic benefits of Brexit.
When people voted in the referendum last year, it wasn't just about leaving the EU. I think they did vote for change. Part of that is about building a stronger economy.
The exit talks will decide issues like how much the UK will have to pay to get out of the EU and eventually what will be its new trading relationship with the bloc. If all goes to plan, Britain could be out by March 29th, 2019. Richard Tice, a leading Leave campaigner.
Well, obviously, we're delighted that we know what day in 2019, finally and delightfully, the United Kingdom will be leaving the European Union.
Not necessarily. The talks could break down. Britain could crash out earlier than scheduled and without a trade deal. Simon Tilford at the Centre for European Reform in Brussels.
There's a real contrast between this rather jaunty optimism of the British government and this sort of rather sceptical mood in Brussels.
The most senior official in Brussels has just said Britain faces a choice, eat what's on the table or don't come to the table at all.
So it's far from obvious that Britain will negotiate as favourable a deal as many think possible.
The first stumbling block could be financial. Brussels negotiators have spoken of Britain paying around $63 billion as an exit fee. The UK government dismissed that figure as laughable. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A word here about Uber and how change, while sometimes hard, might be good big picture-wise. The president of Uber is quitting after just 6 months on the job. Former Target executive Jeff Jones says his approach to leadership was, quote, inconsistent with what he experienced at Uber. It's been tough to miss the bad news that company has been hit with, the Delete Uber campaign, allegations of systemic sexual harassment, and a video of CEO Travis Kalanick getting into it with a driver. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now on startup growing pains.
Founded just 8 years ago as a ride-hailing app, Uber is now worth almost $70 billion. But the Delete Uber campaign, reports of sexual harassment at the company, revelations it used software to dodge law enforcement, have all taken a toll on the brand. Charles Kane is a senior lecturer at MIT's Sloan School of Management.
They have grown so quickly in such a short amount of time that usually the initial management gets overwhelmed.
After the video went viral of Travis Kalanick cursing at an Uber driver, the CEO admitted he needed to grow up and get some leadership help. Uber is searching for a chief operating officer, or COO. Howard Yu at IMD Business School in Switzerland says that's something the aggressive startup had resisted.
The notion of having a COO in charge of regular operation or public affair, it feels a little bureaucratic.
Bringing in a heavy-hitting COO also means ceding some power, which doesn't always come easy to founding entrepreneurs. Lila Bulling Town is an executive coach who's worked with several Silicon Valley startups.
I think the COO is sometimes hands tied a little because there can sometimes, in my opinion, be a lack of clarity around the difference between the two roles.
That may help explain the departure of Jeff Jones, she says, who as president was serving some of the functions of a COO. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, stocks were a little bumpy, a little lumpy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to start a series today about this.
NAFTA has been a terrible deal. The worst trade deal of all time. A total disaster.
That I intend to immediately renegotiate the terms of that agreement.
The North American Free Trade Agreement.
NAFTA could not tell you. What is it?
Much in the news the past year or more, and yet not all that much understood.
What is NAFTA?
Oh. Never heard of it before.
NAFTA. I know this answer, but I don't know this answer.
NAFTA, National Association of I don't know what.
North American. National. I'm close, though.
It's a free trade agreement between America, Canada, and Mexico to. Yeah, I don't know. That's about as much as I can get.
That's an admittedly unscientific sample taped there from Georgia, Washington, D.C., New York City, Michigan, Arizona, and Los Angeles. But given what the president has promised, upending a key element of the American trade economy, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go inside your closet, your liquor cabinet, and your garage. We're going to look at what a baseball game had to do with the original negotiations, and we're going to look back quite a ways to how NAFTA came to be in the first place. For a lot of people, this is the once and future soundbite about NAFTA.
There will be a giant sucking sound going south.
Ross Perot, running as a third-party candidate in 1992 in the first presidential debate that year alongside George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. NAFTA, at that point, was still just an idea being negotiated, a three-way trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada to get rid of most tariffs and set up a system to get rid of other trade barriers as well. Bush the first, who signed the negotiated deal, and Clinton, who signed it into law, get most of the credit or the blame, depending on where you're coming from. But the idea of NAFTA got its first big boost with this guy.
Within the borders of this North American continent are the food, resources, technology, and undeveloped territory, which properly managed could dramatically improve the quality of life of all its inhabitants.
Ronald Reagan in 1979 announcing his run for the White House, calling for a North American accord. Our coverage this week is going to look at two parts of what Reagan said, NAFTA being properly managed and what it has meant for the quality of life of all its inhabitants. Which gets us, in a, yes, roundabout way, to my pants. And yours.
Hi, can I ask you a very quick question about your blue jeans? Can I ask you about your jeans? Can I ask you a question about your blue jeans? Can I ask you about your pants?
Sure.
Do you know where your pants were made? Do you know where your jeans were made?
No.
Do you know how much they cost?
Definitely probably a foreign country.
Definitely probably is. Do you know how much they cost?
No.
Do you care where they were made?
Not really.
Do you know where your blue jeans were made?
I don't know. I get them at the mall.
Do you know how much they cost?
About $50.
Do you care where they were made?
Nope.
Do you know where your blue jeans were made?
No.
Do you know how much they cost?
To make them or to purchase them?
For you to buy them in the store.
$70.
Do you care where they were made?
No.
Excellent. Have a great day. Thanks a lot. Most people, by the way, have no idea what they cost and don't care where they were made. Just in case you're curious.
No, I don't necessarily feel good. I wish you asked one more question.
Come on.
Ask me.
Because you said you don't necessarily feel good about that.
Yeah, I don't necessarily feel good about that.
But that's the honest truth.
Yeah.
You know, I got a good deal on my jeans. They fit. I'm happy about that. But I'm not necessarily proud of who I am because of that.
That was just outside Marketplace World headquarters here in Los Angeles the other day. And that question about whether people care where their jeans come from, I asked one other guy, also wearing jeans, that same thing.
I don't think people really care. It doesn't, because I think what they care more about is the price, right? The value. Is it worth this much or not? And if it isn't, you know, they're not going to buy it. And if they think it is, they will.
That's Peter Kim, the CEO of Hudson Jeans, at his office in Commerce, California. It's about a 20-minute drive or so southeast of downtown Los Angeles. We had him on the show back in February, part of a regular series we do with CEOs called Corner Office. You should check it out if you get a chance. But anyway, Peter told us back then he had moved a lot of production down to Mexico. So once we decided to do this series about NAFTA, we went to see him at work.
Right here is a production department, pre-production and production, customer service over there, more production.
Can I ask you a technical question?
Yep.
So this fabric with the rips and the holes, how do they do that?
There's actually a person who's actually...
No, really?
Yeah, yeah.
So they sit there with like a little razor blade? And
little grinders, sandpaper. The more weathered it looks, the more expensive it gets.
Which makes total sense.
You source your denim overseas, right? Italy, isn't that what you're
Italy
telling?
And Turkey.
And Turkey, right? Here. And then what is it that gets done in Mexico?
So for us, we are doing a full package deal out there. So we partnered up with... two really good factories that we found, and these guys are responsible for start to finish. All we have to do is spot check it in between, but they're running the whole process. So that makes it even more critical that we're partnered up with the right people that believe in the quality, attention to detail, because we're losing control of that piece of it.
What happens to your business if, as the president has talked about, NAFTA either goes away or changes in some way?
That's a big question, which I know Mexico is concerned about, because I've talked to the factory owners down there and they're heavily concerned about that. At the same time, people here are concerned as well, trying to figure out what is the next move.
Could you see a day when you bring production back here to the States?
It's a constant conversation that we have. We actually still do production here. We probably do 15-20%, probably within a 10-mile radius here. Because one of the benefits, I think, about domestic is speed. If something goes wrong, we can react much quicker and make adjustments like on the fly, whereas if it's, you know, in Mexico or anywhere else, you have that transit time. And I was literally, right before you guys came in, I was sitting down with a factory here, a domestic factory, talking about longer-term strategy.
That domestic factory he was talking to, the one still making blue jeans in the U.S., it was this one.
My name is Monty Galbraith. I'm president of DNA Textile Group in Columbus, Georgia.
Tell me a little bit about your company, would you?
Kai, we are a privately held textile company based in Columbus, Georgia. We manufacture primarily apparel fabrics, denim being our feature fabric.
Monty Galbraith's been in textile since he was a teenager. He says the industry and Columbus itself is just a shell of what it used to be.
This was a textile town. There were thousands of looms and hundreds of thousands of spindles all up and down this area. Of course, as times have changed, since NAFTA was put into place, just about everybody has gone out of business. That was in the textile business. There's just a very, very few of us remaining.
The year NAFTA became law, 1994, there are almost 500,000 people working at textile mills in this country. That's making everything: sheets, socks, T-shirts, and the like. Today, says the Labor Department, just over 100,000 people work in textiles. 15 mills in this country used to make denim. Now it's just 3. So I asked Monty Galbraith, given that history, why he still needs NAFTA.
Well, you know, that's kind of a loaded question. NAFTA 20-some-odd years ago, when it was when it was put into place, it, you know, just shattered the textile industry in the U.S. This was a healthy, thriving industry that's now just a shadow of its former self. But as of now, the way that it has settled in, where the production has kind of right-sized to the marketplace today, the way it's working now is the fabrics that we produce in the States do go into Mexico. duty free. And then they come back and finish garments duty free. So therefore, if NAFTA goes away, those rolls of fabric that we would ship into Mexico to be made into garments and come back, full duty would be applied to the total value of that garment coming back. And
could you stay in business if NAFTA went away?
You know, if it went away, which I don't think it is. I think it's going to get renegotiated, and that's, I don't have any inside information, but I've got to believe that there's so many industries, major industries in the U.S. that are so entrenched in the supply chain as the way it flows back and forth between Canada, U.S., and Mexico. But yeah, if you were to take NAFTA and put a 20% border tax on everything coming back, yeah, it would definitely put us out of business. No doubt about it. Because the products that we make all ship down to Mexico duty-free, and they all have to return duty-free. And if that advantage was taken away, it would put us out of business.
There's a lot that's going to happen between now and when or if NAFTA goes away. Coming up, what the thinking was on the Mexican side when the whole thing was being negotiated. Coming up,
we're on the same side of the table, and we are part of the solution, not part of the problem.
The art of the NAFTA deal. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 8 points today, closed at 20,905. NASDAQ up less than a point, just a tad, finished at 5901. The S&P 500 down 4 points, about 0.2%, 23.73 there. Oil prices fell, so too did energy stocks. Transocean and Chesapeake Energy both weakened about 2%. Duke Energy ceded 0.8%. Tech stocks edged higher. Apple shined up 1%. Chipmaker Nvidia nudged up about 3.1%. Microsoft up less than 0.1%. Nektar Therapeutics sweetened 42.2%. The company's experimental pain drug met its goals in a late-stage study. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.46%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Hi, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on Marketplace every day,
technology, the economy, culture, check out our weekly podcast, Make Me Smart. It's a chance to tell us the things you really want to learn more about and share with us the things you know more about than anyone else.
We're at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly is at Molly Wood. Check it out.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lost in the economic hubbub of last week, the Fed's interest rate specifically was good news from real estate. February housing starts were way up, and when you throw in the fact that both consumers and home builders are feeling more confident than they have in years, you might as well say that people are in a buying mood. Only one thing missing, though: homes for sale. Aaron Schrank reports.
It's not like builders aren't trying. Last month, new home construction hit its highest level since the recession, but we're still not building houses like we used to.
The amount of new construction today is only about 65% of the long-term average, so we have a ways to go.
That's Ralph McLaughlin, chief economist at Trulia. And when it comes to existing homes, he says,
inventory is near historic lows.
As in its lowest level since 1999, according to the National Association of Realtors. The group's Jessica Lout says that's making things especially hard for millennials and other new buyers to break into the market.
the homes that are being constructed are not the affordable first-time homebuyer homes. And many metropolitan areas, inventory is so tight. So even if demand is there, it's difficult for them to get into the market.
And it may get harder and even more expensive. Even though interest rates are barely ticking up, mortgage rates have been climbing.
If people are confident that they can buy and they're getting into the buying market, that's going to actually push them off the fence because they're going to want to lock in before rates rise too high.
But rising mortgage rates can work the other way too, says Elliot Eisenberg. He's the founder of economic consulting firm Laughs and Graphs.
The problem is that there'll be fewer houses available for sale a little bit because people won't let go of their old mortgage to buy a new one, to get a new house.
So it's not a bad time to buy a house, but first, you've got to find one. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Back to our NAFTA series now for just a little bit. It's easy with the distance of time to think about it as a thing that just happened and then bang, the economy changed. Truth is, it took people sitting around a conference table hashing things out to get NAFTA done. Carla Hills from the United States, Michael Wilson from Canada, and Jaime Serra representing the Mexican government. We're going to talk to Ambassador Hills and Ambassador Wilson tomorrow. Today, Jaime Serra is on the line. Dr. Serra, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
How did it come to pass that you were the guy sitting at the table doing the NAFTA negotiations 25-ish years ago?
Well, I was then the Minister of Trade for Trade and Industry in Mexico. Our relationship with the U.S., which is a very natural relationship in terms of trade and other fronts, but in trade, was not substantive enough, given the fact that we were neighbors and that we will be neighbors forever. And we had a series of agreements that were just getting to the limit. So it was quite obvious that we had to change the rules in order to have a better trade for both of the countries and Canadians. That's something that I think should be in the mind of the negotiators this time around.
Well, as long as you brought it up, let's skip ahead in the things I wanted to talk about. And let me ask you about this idea that President Trump has of either getting rid of or renegotiating NAFTA. What do you think of that?
Well, I assume there is a sequence, right, that you renegotiate. And if the renegotiation doesn't succeed, then probably any country in the agreement can remove itself from the agreement. I think it could be a mistake because what we have now is a very competitive North American region. For every dollar Mexico exports to the U.S., it has 40 cents of U.S. content in any product we send to the U.S. Well, for every dollar that the Chinese send to the U.S., it has 4 cents of content of American products. So in that sense, Mexico contributes to the competitiveness of the U.S. economy and contributes to the competitiveness of the region as a whole, as opposed to the case of a pure outsourcing, which is the relationship the U.S. has with China and other countries. So as I've been saying, we're on the same side of the table, and we are part of the solution, not part of the problem.
As you know, NAFTA is people are of two minds about NAFTA in the United States. Part of that has been exacerbated by the recent political campaign. I wonder what Mexicans think of NAFTA and where it has taken that economy.
I think that the feeling towards NAFTA in Mexico is a positive one because What it did was basically helped for the country to modernize and to become much more of a manufacturer than just a commodity exporter. As you know, Mexico was and had been before NAFTA, you know, pretty much oil dependent. And now, you know, oil represents very little out of our total export. So the transformation that Mexico has experienced going from, you know, basically oil exporter to be a manufacturing exporter has been very positive. And it has contributed, again, to the growth of manufacturing in the U.S. and manufacturing in Canada because we complement each other.
You understand, though, that if you go to certain places in the United States, the upper Midwest being the most obvious example, that is exactly the opposite of the way people see it.
Absolutely. And I think that there is some confusion there because the reason for the trade deficits the U.S. has or the lack of employment in those areas is not the fact that they have a free trade agreement with Mexico. It's a different kind. It's automation, robots, technological change, different forms of trading, different training for the workers. That is what explains the situation there, not NAFTA. Actually, if you look at the numbers, Kai, 90% of the trade deficit is explained of trade that the U.S. has with countries with whom they do not have a free trade agreement.
If President Trump actually does reopen negotiations on NAFTA, what should Mexico be looking for out of this round of talks?
I think that we need to understand that basically there are two options. One is to introduce protectionist measures within the region, which I think would be suicidal, truly speaking. I think we would be shooting our own foot, because if we introduce protectionist measures within the region, we're going to make the region less competitive. The other approach is to enhance the integration of North America and to make the region more competitive, like, for instance, to be more competitive with China. So if we agree in that general principle, I think that the potential negotiations could improve quite a bit our instruments, our relationship, and therefore the potential benefits for both economies.
I wonder, though, if there's a failure to agree on those basic principles, right? Because President Trump has said pretty clearly NAFTA is the worst trade deal ever negotiated.
Yes, well, I understand that those things were much more of a political moment, I hope, because the evidence shows that that the countries have benefit from NAFTA.
Respecting the fact that you, in your professional life, were a trained negotiator and diplomat, I guess, in some way, do you take it personally when President Trump says all these horrible things about this deal that you spend so much of your time working on?
No, not at all. I'm sure President Trump doesn't mean that to be personal, but more sort of an approach to an issue that he cares very much about. But I don't take it personally. By the way, I think I never studied negotiation or diplomacy. I'm not a diplomat. I'm an economist. And probably that's what helped the fact that I'm not a diplomat. But I don't want to elaborate on that.
Jaime Serra, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Great to talk to you, Kay. Thank you.
As I said, Ambassador Carla Hills and Ambassador Michael Wilson, tomorrow the American and Canadian NAFTA negotiators back in the day. Tune in, if only for a story about Jaime Serra, a baseball game, and getting NAFTA done. Final note on the way out. One small slice of today's hearing into Russian interference in last fall's election. Arkansas Republican Rick Crawford at the mic here.
Despite your expressed disdain for the New England Patriots, I think that Tom Brady would probably like to express his gratitude for the FBI's assistance in recovering his stolen Super Bowl jersey, so I'll do that on his behalf now.
Thank you. By the way, if I'm honest with myself, the reason I don't like the Patriots is they represent sustained excellence. And as a Giants fan, that drives me crazy.
I'm a Giants fan, too. I just don't like the Pats. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 8 points today, 20,905. NASDAQ up less than a point, 5901. The S&P 500 down 4.2%, 2373. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.